Hey everyone. We launch a new section here of papers, a new segment of papers. On sort of right at the beginning of paper 113, which is old single column, page 1241. All right, so like I mentioned right at the end last time, we've finished up that whole sweep through the nature of the adjusters and our relationship to the adjusters. Like I mentioned, we have an obvious complementary loose end here, since we so very much now appreciate how they're working in concert, complementary fashion, to give us this full ability to establish a reflective relationship between the cosmos and ourself, cosmos on one hand, the self on the other, and that side that's really fostered by the angels, and then the side that's fostered by the adjuster. So they've got two papers in here to tie up that loose end, to finish really, finish the whole story of how your potential relationship with the cosmos is fostered. And I don't know if anyone has ever pondered, why are there two papers? I don't know if you've got to think about it in the scheme of the whole book. It's kind of a curious little thing. It's not only, you've got this big long set of adjusted papers, and this big long set of supreme papers, and then wedged in between them. It's not just one transition paper, or a whole sequence. There's two. There's nothing arbitrary about the way the book is constructed, so you can ask that question. Why are there two? And, I would hope that as I've been building up this increased awareness of the two aspects that are engaging us, the two overarching aspects that are engaging us, and if you just think about the titles of the two papers and your basic recognition of what you remember is in those two, Seraphic Guardians of Destiny, and then we have the Seraphic Planetary Government is the other one. Think about the fundamental difference of the content of those two papers. One is addressing the mother-like ministry to mortals, and the second one is the father-like ministry. And, most particularly, when seraphim are functioning in that very mother-like ministry, that's when they'll use she and her to describe your relationship to them. That you can think very much of, they're functioning as daughters of the mother when they're in that mode. And so they're, to appreciate your relationship to them, think of it as a relationship to a she rather than a he. And that's why they use she and her, when the angels are in that mode. But when the angels are functioning, in more of that father-like mode, like we'll read about in the next paper, where, in particular there, it's, the direct engagement of civilization by the Most Highs and the Master Seraphim, etc., the planetary government, that's, an injection into place. That's, Father inserting his hand directly into human affairs. Okay, that's a father-like ministry. That's not the mother-like ministry. Okay? So that's why there's two papers. See, again, and it's just, neither of these, have some big banner at the front that says this paper is about mother-like ministry, this paper is like father-like ministry. But the more you begin to pick up on that basic twofold ministry and, you know, deity engagement character that we experience, the more you can see it. You know, it's just like so many times I pointed out, you go to some paragraph and there's, you know, two clauses or phrases, you know, in some sentence in that paragraph, you know, separated by an and on the one side it's the mother-like, and on the other side it's the father-like. You know, here's a big and in between these two papers, mother and father. Seraphim participate in both ministries.
On the other hand, or maybe these are connected, it sounds like one's personal and one's global, to use just a...
Well, I mean, this is global too. Okay. The mother-like ministry that we're about to read about is very global.
We think about,
you know,
our personal guardian angel,
right? But you know, the master seraphim might be, you know, directly engaging one individual. They may be using one individual like a reservist. You know, again, don't you know? Notice the truth difference in what's going on. You know, not the, you know, the facts are often the same. You know, like it's global or it's individual or whatever. But what's the fundamentally different character of what's going on? You know, is it about, you know, inserting a hand into the normal stream of affairs, like an adjuster is inserted into your normal stream of affairs? Or is it about that which has always been there, you know, and always will be, and because of that you don't even recognize that, you know, that there might be something there if you're taking it for granted? It's just this seamless ministry of upholding. You know, and we're about to read about how they help uphold our relationship, you know, the relationship of that self to the cosmos. You know, that's one of the main things that they're doing as their duty, you know, and their mission. Okay. So, with that little preface, let's jump in and see what they have to say.
Paper 113, Seraphic Guardians of Destiny. Having presented the narratives of the ministering spirits of time and the messenger hosts of space, we come to the consideration of the guardian angels, seraphim devoted to the ministry to individual mortals, for whose elevation and perfection all of the vast survival scheme of spiritual progression has been provided. In past ages on Urantia, these destiny guardians were about the only group of angels that had recognition. The planetary seraphim are indeed ministering spirits sent forth to do service for those who shall survive. These attending seraphim have functioned as the spiritual helpers of mortal man in all the great events of the past and the present. In many a revelation, the word was spoken by angels. Many of the mandates of heaven have been, quote, received by the ministry of angels. Seraphim are the traditional angels of heaven. They are the ministering spirits who live so near you and do so much for you. They have ministered on your Urantia since the earliest times of human intelligence.
Okay. Now, you might, you know, be a little puzzled about why did they dredge up, you know, those proper designations of ministering spirits of time and messenger hosts of space. What's the point of hearkening back, like you remember, you know, way back the paper, messenger hosts of space? And if you can't remember who they are, everyone's perhaps favorite messenger host is anything but touchy-feely, like you might have a vision of an angel being. The divine executioners, you know, are part of the messenger hosts of space. You know, if anyone who's you know, familiar with the Bible or just the word angel, if you look it up in the dictionary, there's a very distinct linkage between the word angel and the word messenger. Okay? And you know, these two biblical quotes they have here in the, at the end of that first paragraph are alluding to that. I mean, it seems very messenger-like what they're describing there. So one of the things that the Revelation is doing is saying, well, you know, that's not really the most appropriate way to think about the seraphim, especially the seraphim in the way that they're directly engaging you. They're ministering spirits of time, not messenger hosts of space. They are angels, not authorities, and not powers either, the higher personalities of the infinite spirit. So they are ministering spirits of time. So they're trying to get you to stop kind of clouding your sense of angels by tying that word messenger so tightly to what they're about. They're about ministering first. So that's why you have that. I'm saying, remember we pointed out that there's those two, and notice we're calling the guardian angels the ministers. They're trying to, right, the very first thing they want to do is give people a new starting point for thinking about angels. And since that's the primary notion that people have in their head tied, with just the name angel, they're trying to reset that. So that's what that's about there. As we move in here, notice what they'll do in these first two sections, again, to get us to now expand upon, fine-tune what they're hoping is a new sense of an angel as a ministering spirit, and tying this word guardian to that really tightly. Okay.
One, the guardian angels. The teaching about guardian angels is not a myth. Certain groups of human beings do actually have personal angels. It was in recognition of this that Jesus, in speaking of the children of the heavenly kingdom, said, "Take heed that you despise not one of these little ones, for I say to you, their angels do always behold the presence of the Spirit of my Father."
Okay, I want to stop there a minute, because this quote, basically biblical quote here, let's just take a little aside for a moment and reflect on this particular quote and how the Revelators use, in this case, a Bible quote. So the first thing, this here is quite close to what you have in a typical Bible. You might suspect the presence of the Spirit of my Father. That sounds very directly adjuster-like language. I'll bet you the Bible doesn't say it quite that way, and of course you'd be right. So here, let me just read you that. It's in Matthew chapter 18, verse 10, the beginning of Matthew's story about the parable of the lost sheep. "See that you do not look down on one of these little ones, for I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven." Okay, so that's what you pretty much have in all the translations of the Bible. So very much like that, face of Father. And so the Revelators are saying, all right, if we have that direct set of words, that could be used with just a slight little tweak to make it more accurate, to the real situation. What is that face? It's the adjuster. Okay, it's as they said there, it's the presence of the Spirit of my Father, the thought adjuster. So, in this instance, they're doing what we know they do a lot. They're sort of taking almost exactly what you can find in a particular translation of the Bible and just tweaking a word or two. And using that as a way to express the truth of the situation, because they're told that know, unless it's doing some disservice, you know, use it as closely as what humans have already, you know, without tweaking it. And so they do that. However, you know, that you know, story that Matthew's in the midst of telling there, you know, is a particular time in Jesus' life. You know, and if you go to you know, the Jesus papers and read that part of Jesus' story, how do the midwayers handle that statement? You know that the midwayers, too, are also, you know, highly paralleling the verbiage in the Bible. How does it work there? It's at the end of the Mount of Transfiguration paper. If you want to know where it is, it's on 1761 in the old single column. That's paper 158, right at the very end. This is in the one of the things that the midwayers point out is that that little line actually is attached to the previous things that Jesus was saying. If you go to the beginning of the next paper, that's the beginning of the lost sheep parable. It's actually attached to what was going on before that in reality, and so the midwayers have fixed that by shifting that statement, you know, into the right story. It's right after the passage that I point out so many times, you know, it would be better if a millstone were hanged about your neck and were cast into the sea. So it's in the context of that, those statements by Jesus, that he says, so the midwayers now recount, he says, but most of all, see that you despise not one of these little ones, for their angels do always behold the faces of the heavenly hosts.
And is that in quotes as well?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right. Okay, so now think about this. See, this is the reason I brought this up, because it's very important to understand the difference between quoting truth and quoting fact. The authors of the book have no need, you know, for human notions of precise wording, you know, being implied by quotes, factual wording. You know, this book is about revealing truth, not facts. If there's quotes in the book, what they're quoting is the truth of what's said. I mean, obviously they're not quoting the literal facts of what says. This is not in Aramaic. Okay, if nothing else. And plus, you know that when they write it in English, if there is words in English already that they can use, they have to, with more or less distortion of meaning. Okay? And so notice what they did. It's basically the same to start out with. That face of the Father, okay, second one, so they use the faces. See, that word is directly in there, faces. But now the Father is nowhere in the quote. It's the faces of the heavenly hosts. You know, for their angels do always behold the faces of the heavenly hosts. Now think about this. Would Jesus really, you know, and this is in relation to, he's using one of Peter's little kids as a case in point, you know, pulling him into the circle, you know, putting this little kid on the spot to be this, a point of discussion about, you know, being as a little child, entering the kingdom as a little child. Okay, it's highly likely, for instance, that little kid and all lots of other little kids that the apostles are going to run into, are, you know, don't have an adjuster. You know, even now, see, and of course, you know, translate this into, you know, speaking of this today, you know, if they're basically pre-6-year-old, they don't have an adjuster. Okay. You know, their angel is not beholding the, you know, the presence of the Spirit of the Father. Right. There's no adjuster there. Right. So, the midwayers, you know, say that, you know, this is the truth of it, you know, and what's the new point? The point is not that there's an adjuster there that the angel sees. What's the point of it? The point that Jesus was really trying to make. The angels of that child behold, in other words, they're always, when they look to the cosmos, which they're always doing, you know, it's not just seeing, but beholding, they're constantly looking at the cosmos, and never, ever do they not see the cosmos looking back. The cosmos has that child in its eyes always. The cosmos never blinks. The cosmos always sees that child. And those angels can testify to that. It's looking, okay? It knows that child exists. Think about it like that. But most of all, see that you despise not one of these little ones. Okay, thinking that, no one's looking. No, someone's always looking, no matter how little the child. Okay. Now, that's the real spirit of what Jesus said. And that's just not really captured as directly in the way it's quoted in the Bible. But, this is where they're trying to really recount what Jesus said in a very truthful way. Whereas up here, the author of this paper, the chief of seraphim, is trying to make a certain point. And he can use that Bible passage more directly, just a little tweak, to really kind of different point. Similar point, but slightly different point. Okay, that's the way the book is constructed. That's the way they use existent English expressions. And they use them very freely. And here's an example where they use it two quite different ways. Now, if you don't know that, if you think, okay, this is a very precise, fact book, and you finally discover that, separated by hundreds of pages, are these two supposed quotes, and they aren't the same, you go, I found a mistake in the book. No. It's not what you did.
So your point being that the quote used by where we're at now, mm-hmm. the seraphim, is more tailored to adjust her into all people.
Right.
As opposed to a child who is pre-adjusted.
Right. And you'll see that as we go forward into this paper. Like I said, the main reason why this paper is here and not, way back, like in the local universe section or something, with the other ministering spirits of time stuff, or at least in the system section or something. Why is it right here? It's right after the adjuster papers, because the whole point is to give you in context, the relationship of the seraphim to the adjusters. So the main point of what they're going to talk about is in the context of when there's an adjuster. And you'll notice it's even more than that. Most of the paper is not even talking about that generally, but when what's over, what's the adjusters engaging is a third circler. Okay? Very much adjuster in play.
So the other thing that it sounds to me like you're pointing out is that written English has certain rules, subject.
Scholarly texts
plagiarism
rules and all that sort of stuff.
And so when you start reading something, you assume that those are in place. I mean, they're using the English language beautifully and, sentence structure and proper words, etc. But in this case, it sounds like the use of the quotes is if you want to find something similar to this in your history, we'll put it in quotes rather than not in quotes, because it's not exactly the perfect translation of the Aramaic of what he thought on this day in whatever it was. But the rules are more of the angelic level, which you were pointing out. It's not the scholarly use of quotes, but of a fact of what was actually said, but of a thought that is a truth point.
They're following.
So they're stretching the use of the quotes.
Right.
Okay.
It's very important to recognize that.
Yeah, all right.
About the quotes. The example I often use just as a real case in point about that is, you're reading through the Jesus papers and in quotes it says, Jesus said blah, 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 and you go, no, that's word for word what Paul said, in Corinthians or something. Okay, I know my Bible, okay? But see, remember, you know, they tell you that they're going to do that. If, you know, because a lot of times they're summing up what Jesus said, you know. And, you know, they need a very pithy expression of the truth of what he said, you know, over that hour. Okay? And it just so happens that Paul put it together very succinctly in the following 12 words. Right. Jesus said, in truth, this. And Paul understood that truth. It's sort of the subtext of that, see? Mm. Okay. That you have to think, you know, in a more dynamic truth sense about the revelation, not that fact finder mode. All right, anyway, it's a little bit of a extended aside, but it struck me as I was, you know, looking at this, like, you know, that would be a really great one to just talk about this a little bit. So you can see that.
You know, I can appreciate that. My fact finder is offended.
Yeah. Yeah. And they want to offend your fact finder because they want to put it in direct contest against your truth seeker and see which one you choose. They're trying to get you to reform your mind. And if you choose fact, your mind will not be reformed. It will stay exactly the same. If you choose to trump the fact with the truth, yeah, and then discover that never ever is there, you know, some disservice to the fact. It's just the point is not the fact. The facts are a means to a truth end.
Yeah. What if you're choosing both?
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make. You do want both, but truth first. Fact second. Because if you put it the other way around, you'll never get to the truth. There's zero probability of you recognizing the truth if you start with the facts and your ignorance. Because that's where we all start. Unless you think that you're different and that you were created in full divine wisdom. Okay? You have to ask yourself this question. Do I start there? Or do I start as a little child, very ignorant, and very, you know, very, very prone to distortion of meaning? Mm-hmm. You know, if I don't challenge myself to put truth first, and then rediscover facts in the light of truth. You know, if the facts are real, the truth flows through them. You never have to blind yourself to real facts. But you will have to let go of a lot of figments that you thought were facts. You know, and you're definitely going to have to let go of a lot of false understandings of even real facts. Yeah. That's the reforming process. You know, to begin to separate true and false, fact and figment. Let alone goodness and evil.
So what in your personal experience prepared you for that? Prepared you to move from more of a factual orientation than a truth orientation? Or do you think that somehow you got schooled by your mother and father?
No, as I look back, I don't see any schooling along those lines. I see a very slow, gradual dawning in my mind that's kind of where I started. I didn't start with a tendency to be biased. The main thing with me individually is if it wasn't clear, I had no knee-jerk tendency to just stick something in there and start running with it. I just put it on the back burner of my mind until it, you know, it became clear, and then and only then did I start to, you know, to try to run with it. So, I may have had a very, very slow start in a number of ways, but I really didn't have any false starts. That's why you've heard me say a number of times. I resonate a lot with one-brainers. I'm quite sure that the way I, the life I've experienced, the maturation I've experienced so far, is a lot like what a one-brainer experiences, where they don't have this overt dichotomy generator, you know, in their ignorant consciousness that a two-brainer does. You know, it means that their normal development is a lot slower, you know, than a two-brainer or a three-brainer, but they also don't get ahead of themselves. And I just, you know, that was just the way I was born. I just never had a tendency to get ahead of myself. So I haven't had to really back up, you know, and start again. I just sort of been slowly, you know, chugging along, you know, dawning in my head.
Andre, wouldn't you think that same question applied to any of us would be pertinent? I mean,
why you would ask. Reflect on that yourself. That's the only reason why I answered it with such, you know, honesty about my, you know, think about that, about your, you know. Everyone is different. That doesn't make me better or worse. It's just everyone's different. Everyone has a different life experience. Just in the same way that one-brainers, two-brainers, and three-brainers aren't, you know, good, better, and best.
Well, one thing to point out, though, is that when you first read this book, I mean, you're reading it as a scholarly book, which it obviously is. And you take for granted some of the rules of the lexicon.
Yeah, that's why they so definitively tell you that they're, you know, what kind of rules they're following. They give you some clues about the revelatory mandate. That the revelatory mandate does not say, you know, take most heed of human, you know, plagiarism laws or something like that. I mean, it's not in the revelatory mandate. Right. I could care less. Okay, it's your problem.
Well, the thing is that anybody that gets through one reading and still thinks that this book has value has started to make that transition. Now, you know, after many readings, a lot of study, you look back and you go, oh, well, I can accept what you just said, that they've stretched the rules of what the way they're going to use the quotes. I have no problem with that. Lots of other people might, but, you know.
There are in many ways they haven't stretched it, they've reformed it.
Okay.
You know, true quotes, not just quotes.
Okay.
So when, let's say, the whole coming to believing in it or recognizing the truth versus fact, when you hear something and it chunks, like, in you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
And it's sort of maybe too startling to believe, or, you know, there's reason to think that it, why would it do that? And then there's things that people tell you all the time, or that you learn in school or learn through churches or whatever, that never felt right. Mm-hmm. Are those the kind of things that are the discernment that you're talking about?
Right. You will find that the more you recognize the difference between fact and truth, the more you'll do just what you did. You found yourself needing to use the word feel to describe the experience with truth. But fact, like, I don't feel facts. They're just there. See, and I also can't obey facts, but I can obey truth. If you can begin to really, you know, cultivate that difference of recognition, they're both recognitions, but one of the one recognition seems to have a feeling attached to it, and the other one doesn't. That's an important step forward, you know, and really beginning to discriminate there in your mind. And you're going to feel error also. The more that you can feel truth, you'll feel error. You know,
it's like when you hear something come from somebody and you should... You would think they would be telling you the truth or whatever, and you know it's not.
Right.
It's,
but I can't feel figment like that. See, so this is another reason to recognize, oh, why I really need to put my truth error sensitivity right up front, you know, and then, you know, approach that issue of fact and figment. And if you clearly can say, okay, this is truth and this is error, that truth is going to be connected to facts. truth can't be connected to figment, but error can. Okay. Error doesn't have to be, so it's important to have a fact figment discriminator too. That's the first cosmic intuition. You know, it could be going from fact to ungoodness, and that would be an error. Yeah. But, you know, it's just because this is, you know, in the mind, that discrimination is felt in the mind. Yeah, you can feel that. Yeah. All right, so, yeah, so anyway, just, you know, you picked up on it really well, just noticing the difference between the use of that Bible passage and how that really, you know, it's in the very first paragraph here, starting the story, and they're just setting it right up. It's, well, this is really going to have something to do about the Spirit of the Father. This is really tied to adjusters. The exact recognition they wanted you to have. They're trying to get you in that mode right away.
Well, I wouldn't have had that unless I had listened to your...
Right. But of course, that's the level at which they've composed this thing. Like I said, I mean, the more you know, the more you can be where they want you to be. Okay? They're expecting that you are a full biblical scholar here, and, you know, and everything. And then the preface in this first paragraph, this section one, you know, you're supposed to have that whole thing already in your head, and you're going, oh, wow, I see what they're doing here. I mean, that they didn't tell you that, but they're expecting that of you. This is not grade school written for grade school, you know, or even middle school, or even high school. Okay? This is, you know, this is time, you know, we've said this many times. Yes, Jesus came to tell you the good news that not only can you, but you should begin as a child of God. This is about beginning to move towards being an adult of God. You don't do that in grade school. You've got to go beyond the simple. You've got to start to really have a grasp of the bigger picture. Okay.
Originally, the seraphim were definitely assigned to the separate Urantia races. But since the bestowal of Michael, they are assigned in accordance with human intelligence, spirituality, and destiny. Intellectually, mankind is divided into three classes. One, the subnormal minded, those who do not exercise normal willpower. Those who do not make average decisions. This class embraces those who cannot comprehend God. They lack capacity for the intelligent worship of deity. The subnormal beings of Urantia have a corps of seraphim, one company, with one battalion of cherubim, assigned to minister to them and to witness that justice and mercy are extended to them in the life struggles of the sphere.
Okay. Now, remember I jumped forward way back and pointed to this. It's very important to recognize that they've chosen to use the word normal and a spectrum relative to that word normal in two different ways in the Revelation, a horizontal way and a vertical way. This is the vertical way. Where in the horizontal way is basically horizontally, you're pretty much in number two here, in the vertical. Okay? Here, you know, we've literally brought in the vertical sense, you know, this subnormal is, you know, subhuman. You know, they're not functioning with a mind of will dignity. They're functioning below the level of mind, you know, where the seventh adjutant is in play. And it could be worse. I mean, there may be not even a sixth or whatever. But, you know, but this, you know, first, you know, category, number one here, is about those who at the very least the seventh adjutant can't engage. So they can't be encircled in the Holy Spirit. Personality cannot manifest through that system. Spirit of truth can't engage it. Adjusters can't come to it. Okay, that's, you know, functioning with, you know, just, you know, animal mind. Might be very fancy animal mind, but animal mind, not human mind. And you notice that when they wrap that their statement up there, this little statement, that's giving you a little bit of an answer to what we ran into in number one back in the last little list in the previous paper when we had 1, 2, 3. Back in section 3 of the previous paper when we were talking about spiritual or soul death. And remember they made the statement, but this release of the adjuster, you know, so soul's dead, adjuster leaves, but this release of the adjuster in no way affects the duties of the personal or group seraphim concerned with that adjuster abandoned individual. Remember we pointed out, you know, I told you to note that and remember it as we went forward. Well, you know, here's a really good example of them tying back to that, you know, because you're left kind of wondering here. It's like, well, okay, what are the duties of the personal or group seraphim? Okay, see, look at here. What do they tell you about those duties? Their duty is to minister to them and to witness that justice and mercy, you know, were extended to them during the mortal life. It's their duty. Even in the case of an iniquitous being, like they were talking about back there, where, you know, there's absolutely nothing here. This doesn't go, you know, that whole bit about destiny, like they just mentioned in the little preface there, intelligence, spirituality, and destiny. Okay, there's zero destiny back there with that iniquitous individual. But it doesn't matter. There's still a duty in play. Those angels have a duty to be able to bear unshakable witness to the facts that they were engaged in. So that no one in the universe can say, well, you know, I think that they just weren't given the right opportunities. You know, they weren't given enough help. There wasn't enough mercy extended to that individual. You know, I think we should rise up in rebellion because our administrators are not, you know, properly caring for us. No. There's infinite information that's brought to bear, you know, practically, to testify to the facts for all to see clearly. You know, and the angels play a very key role in that. So, now, in this case, we could be talking about two different flavors here. You could have someone, because of the way things went on this planet, you could literally have someone that has an expression of a very recessive phenomena stemming from the back mating way, way, way back when, you know, and they literally are fundamentally not human. You know, they may be shaped like a human and everything and do all kinds of fancy mind tricks, okay? But, you know, it's not that there's been some sort of technicality that's come in and short-circuited, you know, their development up to you know, seventh agent engaging. They're just fundamentally not human, fully human. Okay, well, then they're just going to be witnessing to that. But you could have a situation, we've talked about this before, you know, what if it's basically, you know, human, but there's just some little technical issue in play so that, If that hadn't entered in, if that was corrected, they could get a proper start. The probationary nursery is all about, you know, like if you have perfectly good chromosomes, but you got 3 of one instead of 2, you know, you have trisomy, Down syndrome. I mean, there's nothing fundamentally wrong. It's just, you know, implemented improperly. If it was implemented properly, you know, it could get a proper start. You know, so, you know, that's also in play here. You know, it may be, and they can testify to that and everything. And of course, you know, if you remember the way that works, the cherubim are in charge of knowing the exact DNA in play so that when they build a material body for them on the probationary nursery, it's all done properly and all that. So those, you know, that's what's in play.
So would another one be, you know, brain damage, car accident or explosion or whatever.
Well, that's, you know, kind of like what they were referring to back there. I mean, you know.
I mean, you can still be alive.
Yeah, quite. I mean, especially post-Pentecost, you know, a lot of this, a lot of the gray area has kind of been taken out of this, you know, as, you know, so that now, you know, it's pretty clear that you just had a vicissitude, you know, short circuit the thing, you know, if it happened post, basically 6 years old, you know, tree fell on you or whatever.
Get electrocuted or something.
Right, right. Or, but, but you know, even if you die because of some vicissitude prior to being a jester, you know, we know that that's what the probationer nursery is for and all that. Okay. And, you know, the thing too to let me hold on before I say that. Just read that next little tiny one there. And then I'll
Number two, the average normal type of human mind. From the standpoint of seraphic ministry, most men and women are grouped in seven classes in accordance with their status in making the circles of human progress and spiritual development.
Okay. So they don't really say anything there except, you know, to foreshadow what they're just about to talk about, that the main issue is, you know, what circle you're on in terms of how the angels are engaging you. So it's just all the average humans. But now think about it, you know, and one of the things that's in that category is that pre-seventh circle or child. You know, they're definitively developing on their way up, but something cuts it short. And even if something doesn't cut it short, what's the issue with those little children that are pre-adjusted in terms of the relationship to the angels, to the guardian angels? And they remind you way back. You know, again, if you go back to all the probationary nursery stuff and a lot of that, you know, they have some of these other details. For those pre-adjusted children, they're very much treated as still attached to their parents. Because, like I've tried to point out, they literally are mindily connected. You know, they haven't separated themselves mindily from their parents. And so, you know, in terms of the angelic ministry, a child, pre-adjusted child, you know, is definitively being ministered to in the same way that the more advanced parent is being ministered to. It's attached to the parents in terms of the angelic ministry. If one's a seventh circle, you know, one parent's a seventh circler and one parent's a sixth circler, that child is getting ministered to in a sixth circle angelic ministry way. You know, and even once they get an adjuster, it still may be that way. But once you have once that child has an adjuster, there's the potential for the child to develop and pass their parents. You know, and if the child passes the parents, okay, well then they're going to be ministered to in their own way. But definitely, without an adjuster, there's not even a possibility that the child's going to pass the parents. The child is subject to the parents. You know, they have to live with whatever mind the parents, you know, are molding around them, you know, for better or for worse.
So. What's the maximum age to stay in the probationary nursery?
You know that, like you just mentioned there, that you really have the distinct possibility of taking up a separate ascension career after roughly age 16. But, you know, there's a very limited lifespan for those kids in the probationary. If you're just giving them a chance to get that full choice, and you know where the age of choice is, that's age 20. So, you know, they're basically going to be given, you know, it's mostly 16, you know, and you've got that extra up to the, you know, if things haven't really happened somewhere around the age of choice, I mean, you can, you know, who knows if it's spot on exact or anything, there might be some fuzz in it, but anyway, somewhere around that age of choice has got to be the end of the lifespan of those material bodies that they create. You know, the child is going to get a chance to choose. You know, and see the key there, what are you choosing? You know, what's that real choice? I just pointed it out. you know, you start out, you're very much within the same mindal space as your parents. The more you apply personality to your mind, the more you begin to separate. And at roughly age 16, that's when you can separate mindally. I mean, obviously, you can't be an independent ascender if you haven't separated mindally from your parents. You're descending with them still. You're attached to them, literally. Okay, but, you know, so that's the choice that you're making. Have you chosen to begin a separate ascension career? You know, and if you go back and read that, you know, you see that's, you know, that's the choice they're talking about. You know, and what that literally looks like is literally, you know, here's my mind and here's mom and dad's. Okay, I'm separate now. I can go on my own.
I'm just curious, why do you think that the body would be, you know, it's being recreated from, you know, pretty much the same genetics. They're aside from reproductive potential and all of that. So what is your reason for thinking that person doesn't last 60, 70, 80 years in that body?
Just because there would be no reason to. I mean, obviously it's you know, there's no definitive statement. You know, and that's why I said it, you know, with a bit of caveat. But I would be highly surprised if they're that wasteful with time. I mean, think about the way it worked for Adam and Eve's children. You know, it was literally age 20, spot on. Okay, you know, if you were prior to that, you had no choice. You know, after that, you did. You could stay with mom and dad, or we'll take you to a dentist. Limited choice, but a choice. yeah, I mean, I just think, I mean, you know, what in the world do you need, you know, drooling 90-year-old people, you know, in the probationary nursery for? I mean, what's the point of that? That just looks amazing.
For the diapers.
I mean, I would think that they're, you know, the whole point is not to for them to live a whole mortal life. They've already missed their chance. You know, they're not going to become finaliters. They're going to become permanent citizens. Fair enough. The point is just to give them an opportunity to choose. That one simple choice. Choose, you know, remember, it tells you that, if, you know, they basically say that it's pretty much going to be happening by age 16, and then you can tell there's a little bit of fudge in that, you know, which you can fill in the blank. Oh, yeah, that's right, the age of choice is 20. You know, but right after they tell you that you pretty much just have 16-year-olds there as the oldest kids, they say, and if after that, you know, a choice has not been made for the ascension career, if you haven't chosen to be a separate mindal phenomenon, or if you've chosen iniquity, off you go. You know, they turn you off. So, you know, what would be the easiest way to implement that? You know, rather than, you know, putting them on the chopping block and killing them, why not just design the bodies to last just long enough for a true choice to be made, and then the body just dies. It all happens as naturally. It just seems like the more efficient way.
Is that why when teenagers get around 16 years old, the Lucifer rebellion kicks in?
Right. See, it's very important to recognize that, you know, when the Revengers tell you that thing about 16, it's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, humans figured that out a long time ago, that there's something about 16, roughly age 16. You know, that's when the child, you know, has a separate mindal activity, and you know, and that's when, you know, the parent may, or the child still may have a lot of respect for their parents, maybe, you know, where they might still look to their parents for assistance. But, you know, after roughly age 16, you know, the thought more in the kid's head is, well, I may ask my parent, but, you know, I'm going to make the decision here. You know, but before that, If you think about it carefully, even if they're kind of rebellious, you know, they're still kind of looking to the touchstone. It's like, you know, mom and dad, now where should I be here? You know, they're still kind of curious about where mom and dad are, you know, because they know they shouldn't be too far from that. Okay, but once you get past age 16, they don't care how far away mom and dad are. Because they have a separate, and just recognizing that, you know, that all these sorts of things have to have a literal facts behind them. This isn't all just, you know, some sort of magical stuff going on inside of humans' heads. This is all literal. The way that's, the reason it's literal like that is they literally are sharing mindal space prior to that age.
Is it really possible to choose iniquity at age 16, 17, 18, around there?
Yeah, well, see, and that just adds to what I was saying. I mean, if you read between the lines of what they do tell you, you're going, wow, that sounds like an accelerated process to me. You know, if they're literally suggesting, you know, it literally says, you know, and if after that they haven't, you know, I mean, it all makes it sound like it's not all, you know, if after 40 years, it just doesn't, the way the sentence written doesn't sound like that. It sounds like in very short order after age 16, if they haven't chosen to be an ascender or have chosen iniquity, off they go. That's the way it's written. So you have to kind of just take what they've...
Well, then I should have been gone because when...
Yeah, but you're not in the probationary nursery. Your body wasn't built from scratch. Yeah. You're a reproductive being, you know. They have bodies built for them.
Special. Oh, so this isn't here on this planet. Oh, okay.
No.
I'm confused.
Only in the probationary nursery.
Because at 16, I was so torn, and I said, I don't believe that there is a God.
You know that's utterly illogical here. Yeah. It's not
well,
true.
At 16, I didn't.
No, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That it couldn't be like that here, you know.
Okay, so, got it.
Okay. All right, so anyway, so you've got the, you know, really the subhuman, and then you've got the human, the number two here. But then there's kind of the, you know, the quasi-superhuman phenomenon in number three here.
Three, the supernormal-minded. Those of great decision and undoubted potential of spiritual achievement. Men and women who enjoy more or less contact with their indwelling adjusters. Members of the various reserve corps of destiny.
Corps in that case.
Reserve corps of destiny. No matter in what circle a human happens to be, if such an individual becomes enrolled in any of the several reserve corps of destiny, right then and there, personal seraphim are assigned. And from that time until the earthly career is finished, that mortal will enjoy the continuous mercy and unceasing watch care of a guardian angel. Also, when any human being makes the supreme decision, when there is a real betrothal with the adjuster, a personal guardian is immediately assigned to that soul.
Betrothal. Okay, I mean, a lot of this latter part is kind of foreshadowing what we're going to talk about in more detail. Like, for instance, what is the supreme decision as opposed to a supreme decision? You know, that's coming up at the beginning of the next section. So we'll talk about it there. But the key thing that they're pointing out here, so you have this whole spectrum of human expression that related to the increasing levels of the psychic circles. But things are fundamentally in a different mode if you're a first circler, which is one of the things they're alluding to here. See, men and women who enjoy more or less contact with their indwelling adjusters, that's a first circler. Okay, so and think about what's fundamentally super normal-minded about that situation. We touched on it just in the previous paper. So this whole time, you've had basically an adjuster-minded self that the personality is been seated on. But once you get to first circler, now you transfer, the personality seat is transferred to the Mrancha mind energy system. The adjutant mind system is still there, but the personality is seated on the other mind system. Just like before that, the Mrancha mind system was there, but the personality was seated on the adjuster. self, not the Marantia self.
You mean the adjutant self?
The adjutant self, excuse me, yeah. Sorry. I hope I only said that one time. Okay. The adjutant self. And remember, they alluded to that, and I kind of pointed it out, that when you're in that state, you have, you know, you literally have this higher being phenomenon superimposed upon, you know, that other self. That's, you know, a super normal state, where you have this very direct, you know, superimposition in play. And the other one is a reservist. You know, you've got this reservist with this normal adjutant self going on here, and you literally have beings, higher beings, in the superconscious domain, the higher domains of the mindful energy system. They're literally in there manipulating things. So you have this superimposition of a being's engagement in the mindful energy system upon this adjutant self. So in the one case, you're the being. You know, the new Marantia self, you, is that being that's the superimposition. And in this case, it's other beings that are training the superconscious of that reservist. Okay, so those two situations are separate. You know, there's more going on there than just the normal adjutant mind self phenomenon.
You have a sense of an example? I mean, Paul, Gautama, philosopher. Do you have anybody in mind who would fit one of these categories?
Well, Philo was definitely a first circler. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've pointed that out a number of times. This is completely obvious if you read Philo. Mm-hmm. You know, he's one of the great teachers. Doesn't mean that the other ones were first circlers necessarily, but you know, he is definitively describing experiences with his adjuster. You read his writings. You know, and like I try to point out, I mean, I'm pretty sure that's actually where they get the phraseology thought adjuster, mystery monitor, father fragment.
Oh, really?
Is from Philo. Mm-hmm. If you look at the way what Philo said in Greek is often translated into English, you know, a couple words or something, you know, in English, you go, you know, I bet you could translate that as father fragment instead of whatever they said. You know, if you were a Greek scholar with recognition of the revelation and were translating Philo, you know, you might definitively use thought adjuster, mystery monitor, father fragment, you know, for those, mm-hmm. what, you know, the various things that Philo said.
Chris, at this particular point, when you're flirting with first circling, mm-hmm. Isn't fusion imminent?
No, not imminent at all. As a matter of fact, you know, in extreme cases, you could go on as a first circler for a very, 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 very long time. You know, you may go all the way up through the constellation and the local universe and whatnot. I mean, you could be a first circler for a long time. You have this very definitive, like, that's why it's kind of separate here. Number two is you're definitively moving up to psychic levels. You get to a first circler. Okay, now everything changes. Now there's a whole new process in play with a totally different time constant to it. And a time constant that is much more fundamentally personal, hence absolutely unique. One personality may be able to take their first circular self and, you know, synchronize it and lock it onto the adjuster in very short order. Another personality may take a very, very long time, you know, to manipulate that self in intimate contact with the adjuster until you figure out the way it's meant to lock on. It could take thousands and thousands of, you know, years. It could take a very long time.
Jesus, I've been thinking lately that, well, it's probably pretty obvious, but from the time he finished his Mediterranean tour until he started his public ministry, those transition years, it seems to me he was in first circular, especially where they talk about what he did, but they really don't go into the thought process that he was. It was strange. It's just a strange time. And he seems to be in a lot of intimate communication.
Right. Now, he's you know, if you look closely, that's a fun thing to do. I've mentioned it before. You know, to carefully read the early part of the Jesus story and look, try to see if you can figure out when he's going through the various circles or, and whatnot. Remember how they say that, you know, in some supreme cases, you know, there may be a little bit more intimacy with the adjuster earlier on. And of course, obviously, you might suspect that Jesus would be one of those cases. You know, and you do if you look closely at what they say, you know, even starting quite a ways back, you know, they indicate he was starting to have some contact. You know, so pre-first circler, he was starting to get a little connection. But, you know, he would have been in, you know, real fullness, obviously, just like everyone as a first circler. Other things you can look for, this whole mindal separation point. You know, remember, he started doing it as fast as it can be done. You know, so when does he get his adjuster? At roughly age 6? No. It's actually about 4.5, okay? Yeah. A little bit short of 4.5. He's very precocious, in these things. Okay, so, and that roughly age 16, you know, when's it for Jesus? It's well in advance of 16. You know, he's not even 13 yet. He's separated, and the brilliant evening star shows up and says, it's time to be about your father's business. Okay? Because now he can. Before that, he's not going to be dragging Joseph and Mary up, okay, on this, okay? He's got to get separated first before he can be about his father's business.
Plus, he had kind of a pretty good thought adjuster.
Right. Well, yeah. See, that's part of the reason why he's pushing the envelope on the time. You know, he's got, you know, this incredibly adept self-acting adjuster. You know, self-acting, you know, from the get-go. Yeah. Not just when he gets the third circler. Hmm. You know, it's probably, you know, self-acting way back with Machaventa. Right. I would think. Right. So it's an extremely experienced adjuster. And of course Gabriel picked the DNA and stuff well too, and so everything is accelerated. Yeah. All right. So they wanted to just give that little basic, and now they're going to talk a little bit more about these things they keep sort of saying ahead of time, which is kind of curious the way they constructed this, the way they sort of are jumping the gun, before they give an extensive discussion. But it appears to me that they wanted to kind of help you to tie what they're going to say back to this little three bullet point thing, you know, by kind of saying really more than they needed to say for the sake of the bullet point.
In the ministry to so-called normal beings, seraphic assignments are made in accordance with the human attainment of the circles of intellectuality and spirituality. You start out in your mind of mortal investment in the seventh circle and journey inward in the task of self-understanding, self-conquest, and self-mastery. And circle by circle you advance until, if natural death does not terminate your career and transfer your struggles to the mansion worlds, you reach the first or inner circle of relative contact and communion with the indwelling adjuster.
Two things there. Notice the so-called. Like I was saying, there's two ways that they used normal. And so they're basically reminding you that, the way we are using the word normal in this context, this so-called, not the other way. If you just stop and think a second, it's like, that word wouldn't be there if there was only one way they used normal. And it's also the least utilitarian way, what we're just doing here. I mean, the real sort of normal distribution, the bell curve, humans are under is that horizontal one, with being very limited mindedly, but fully human, very advanced mindedly, and human. That's the real normal distribution. This is more just, thinking of it in three crude levels, but Yeah, again, what else word are you going to use? You know, they threw in average, but, you know, that was kind of a little inadequate, so they decided they needed to use normal here too. So in this calling of, this so-calling of the word normal. Let's see, there was something else there too. Oh, yeah. This whole bit about the circle. See, first, their inner circle of relative contact and communion with the indwelling adjusted. Remember the picture we have now that allows you to visualize this very directly. Works really well, the, you know, the analogy that we've created for this setting. That, you know, we have this self with the two domains, you know, the lower, basically, adjutant dominated domain, and the upper, more spiritual domain, the temple, you know, of your nature, that upper domain. The domain where the actual contact with the cosmos is occurring. The domain that the adjuster is most intimately concerned with, whereas the seraphim is worried about getting this connected to that, better. And if you think about and again putting the levels of meaning in there, so you take that adjutant self and you expand it up through all the levels of meaning, so that you have a full cosmic span in some regard, and you think of it as making a circle of cosmic character up there in that upper domain. See, and you can just literally visualize what they're saying there. So think about the circles in that picture. Then in that upper domain, you create this wide circle. You know, these first circles, if you will, of character. There's seventh circles of character. And the more you grow cosmically, the tighter those circles become. You're moving inward towards the adjuster, which is this rod of father character that's been inserted into that mind. Those circles are moving in on the circumference of that rod until finally they're in intimate contact with it, just like they said there, as a first circle. And then, like I said, it's... And you ride the elevator up and transfer the seat of your identity from this self to that self. It's just very nicely pictured, but what they're just saying there in that, so that you can literally visualize how a first circler is in intimate contact with their adjuster. So this is another way you see how handy that analogy is, why we've used it so much recently. Okay.
Human beings in the initial or seventh circle have one guardian angel with one company of assisting cherubim assigned to the watch, care, and custody of 1,000 mortals. How many are in the company?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm glad you said that. I forgot to mention that back in the number one. This, where it's all of this basically subhuman individuals. There's a company of seraphim and a battalion of cherubim, okay, for all of them. In other words, there's 144 pairs of seraphim, and for each pair of seraphim, there's 12 pairs of cherubim, sanabim. Okay, that's the difference between company and battalion is factor 12. See, so for each pair, there's 12. So there's a battalion of cherubim. So now here, you've got this one pair of seraphim for the 1,000, and you have 144 pairs of cherubim, sanabim, assisting.
So you're going to have to talk about singular plural.
Yeah, well,
it says one guardian angel.
Yeah.
That's a pair.
And that's a pair. Yeah, and you'll see, they, as they go forward, they...
Clarify.
They occasionally say, well, of course, we actually mean two. But yeah, you always want to be translating that. One cherubim is actually two cherubim. One seraphim is actually two cherubim.
But the truth literally is they probably work, as far as our consciousness is concerned, together as
they're complemental pairs. They work very much.
In the sixth circle, a seraphic pair with one company of cherubim is assigned to guide these ascending mortals in groups of 500. When the fifth circle is attained, human beings are grouped in companies of approximately 100, and a pair of guardian seraphim with a group of cherubim is placed in charge.
Group?
Well, no, notice the next one, no.
Upon attainment of the fourth circle, mortal beings are assembled in groups of 10, and again, charge is given to a pair of seraphim, assisted by one company of cherubim.
Again, they try not to be too mechanical in their sentence writing here. But the whole point is...
vary their word.
For this whole thing, you've got... and notice the transition. So in this whole mode, from 7th through 4th, circular, you have one pair of seraphim and one company of cherubim. Just a company, just 144 pair of cherubim. And you notice on the previous one, it was pretty heavy on the cherubim, in that number one there. Fundamentally, why? Because the cherubim and the seraphim are more directly concerned with the more material issues in play. Whereas the seraphim are concerned with the mindful issues in play more directly. Okay. And so there's always, a certain amount of material issues in play that the cherubim, a given set of number of cherubim, need to take care of. But what's really changing here is more, the mindful issues that the pair of seraphim are dealing with are becoming more and more significant and require less and less distribution of their attention. Initially, there's so little mindless stuff of any consequence going on that one pair can handle 1,000. But we're moving closer and closer to where it takes a pair to handle one individual. Because there's there's a third circle, and now you have some real mind stuff going on here. It's starting to really be a phenomenon that can have a significant connection going on between the upper and lower spheres of your self here. Prior to that, you're heavily weighted down here. And, the seraphim can do a little bit sort of in preparation, but, they kind of have to wait for you to... get your ducks in a row.
We'll check back. Got plenty of time.
Not a lot of attention is required.
So the idea is what Paul said to entertain. You could possibly be entertaining angels.
Well, that's here we're not talking about externally yet. Okay. Here we're just talking internally. You'll see they bring in the external stuff later on in the paper. Yep.
It talks about the subnormal minded. Now, it doesn't tell you really how many are in this group, but they have one company of seraphim and one battalion of cherubim, which seem like a lot for a small group of people.
Well, maybe there's 10
planet.
Million.
That's the whole planet, though, right?
It's a whole planet.
There could be a lot of them.
Yeah.
What's the whole planet?
6 billion.
What that group is ministering to. Well, those seraphim and cherubim in number one there are ministering to all of the subhuman individuals on the planet.
Are there a lot?
Yeah. Lots and lots and lots.
Yeah.
statistically.
Where are they?
It's a benighted sphere.
They're right there all around us.
Don't call them. They'll call you.
They don't have to be... like I've tried to point out, they don't have to be, this malignant, marauding, iniquitous phenomenon. Okay, those are subhuman too. They could be very passive individuals.
Docile.
It's very, a lot of individuals do not have full mindful character. They stay as a little child their whole life.
They're probably not even not even interested in self-improvement, really.
Yeah.
You know, they're just go through the
daily thing. It's a very matter-of-fact animal-like existence.
What percentage of the population would you say?
I don't know.
Probably 1 or 2%.
But I'm just saying, you know, take a guess. I mean, if a pair of seraphim handle 1,000, of 7 circlers, okay, and you got, let's say maybe they handle 10,000. You know, just take a wild guess. Okay, one pair handles 10,000. Okay, well, so you got 144 times 10,000. Yeah, that's a lot. Now maybe they handle 100,000. Well, then you got even more. I mean, you could speculate, try to make some guess about, you know, how many beings could that group of angels handle?
Statistically.
Okay, I thought they were just talking about like the brain damage. We were talking about Down syndrome and stuff like that.
Well, that's a lot right there.
There's a lot there too.
There's an awful lot right there. They're not functioning at a full human level because of, you know, basic mindful issues. But then there's also going to be a lot of individuals that are, you know, like I try to point out, that are just, you know, that are not so, you know, so much of a simple medical, you know, recognizable problem like that. You know, they seem to be a fully functioning human individual, but, you know, if you think about it in the context of Revelation, they're subhuman. They don't have minds of will, dignity. They have no consciousness of morals. They have no moral consciousness. They're not encircled in the Holy Spirit.
Right.
They have no God consciousness at all.
Right.
So you
find
them
largely on
Dr.
Phil.
It used to be Jerry Springer.
Yeah, the Jerry Springer crew.
Right. I mean, I know this is always, every time I bring this up, I know that you're not going to be satisfied with anything I can say. Just recognize the Revelation tells you they're there, and they're not free people. Okay? There's a lot of them.
Listen, 130 million people is 2% of the population.
So there's some in this room.
2% of the population.
Yes. I believe you're here because you have a God consciousness.
Yeah.
Okay,
who
then
would
we're living among
them.
2 hours.
Chris, there's nothing to panic over that, right?
Well, I mean,
those people won't be panicked anyway.
Just saying. Come on.
You're the designated panic.
Yeah,
fear not, the Master said.
Fear not, okay. But, you know, as apostles, they carry weapons sometimes.
When a mortal mind breaks through the inertia of animal legacy and attains the third circle of human intellectuality and acquired spirituality, a personal angel, in reality too, will henceforth be wholly and exclusively devoted to this ascending mortal. And thus, these human souls, in addition to the ever-present and increasingly efficient indwelling thought adjusters, receive the undivided assistance of these personal guardians of destiny in all their efforts to finish the third circle, traverse the second, and attain the first.
Comment for Don. See the way they worded that last line there, you know, where they're really talking about, okay, you've got this span through third, the span through second, and then you attain the first, because it really changes there. You know, you're in intimate contact there. You know, you can't make the circle smaller. Okay, so there's not this whole range of first circlers that are making their circles smaller. Like there's ranges of sevens and sixes and fives. Okay,
yeah.
You know, you're there. Now you've got to try to figure out how to, you know, get that to lock on to the adjuster. Now that you have a hold of it.
All right, question.
Yeah.
So then are we, hopefully, most of us, all of us here.
Seven circlers?
Third circlers?
No.
Oh, please.
No.
Oh, you are so
yeah.
We're all third circlers.
No. Not? Be thankful you've got, you're one of 1,000.
Sexuality is spirituality.
And
still one of 25.
Be thankful you're not in category number one.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
subnormal. You usually say it's good to start somewhere, right?
Yeah. But also, good to start somewhere.
But also, Chris, they're leaving us in suspense because they're not really telling us anything more than third circler.
Who are the third?
Yeah, they didn't write the last sentence.
Right. They gave us the third circler, but
nothing,
I'm just saying...
Nothing changes relative to Angel.
How can we really recognize first circler is what I'm saying, between a third circler.
None of us.
What I'm trying to
do. You can carry a car.
You can go back.
We're all like...
But you got branded.
No, we've talked about that. Go back and read. Go back and read the psychic circle section. What does it say is the difference between the third and the first circler? Read it carefully and think about it. Okay, if I was face to face with a third circler and a first circler, and I got to know them personally, really got to know them, how would I start to have a sense that there was a difference there?
Especially if you're nowhere near being either, how are you going to have that sense?
There's the first thing to recognize. You may be too clueless. You can distinguish between the two.
Rules before swine.
Highly likely.
Yeah.
However, there are a couple of things, even a little bit, like I just pointed out, I never met Philo. He lived a little before I did. I can read a book, though, things he wrote, and it's trivially obvious he was a first circler. Okay? If he wasn't a first circler, he wouldn't be talking like he's talking. Only a first circle ever talked like that.
So same thing with Jesus.
But,
right.
Yeah, I mean, you just don't, you're not going to be struggling to try, I think I'm in contact with something in my mind. How would I describe this experience? People who aren't first circlers aren't struggling for words. Maybe I could call it a thought adjuster or something like that. I mean, so that's one of the big clues. But a third circler, forget about that for a second. It's just, kind of more to your point is the third circler. I mean, ask yourself what it would be like in your mind if you were a third circler. Step over here to the temple, to the objective reference point, and take an objective look at that self. If that self was a third circler, what would I be looking at? I'd be looking at an individual who has all seven adjutants fully in play. I would be looking at an individual who, when he's confronted with a situation, knows just exactly, what the right balance is between his third adjutant and his, fourth adjutant. What the volume knob should be set on for the fifth adjutant, the first adjutant. He would be a lot like Jesus, was, even at a very young age. Think about what, the little story or investigation that John was alluding to there. Go back and look at how Jesus engaged people during during that private ministry time. He's confronted with a circumstance. And is he caught flat-footed? Does he regret afterwards? Man, if only I had added a little bit more third adjutant to that situation, so that I would have been more balanced in the way I. No, take a cold, critical look at yourself. And ask yourself.
Earlier in his life, he did question.
He was still learning. Earlier on. Next time.
Yeah, he's making the circle.
I could have a better balance with my adjutants than I did. The proportions were off. It wasn't symmetric. What I did. If you are still in the mode where it's obvious that you didn't deal with that situation in perfect symmetry, perfect in quotes. With great symmetry. You're not a third circler. If you're going, I could have been more courageous there. It sure would have been nice if I hadn't been so clueless there, and had a little more knowledge that I brought to bear on that situation. Or if only I had a little bit more ability to to express a natural social engagement, with another individual. Or if only I had been a little less zealous there, a little more temperate, all those things. See, that indicates that you haven't gotten up to third circler yet. If you're at that point, if you finally have all the adjutants working in symmetry, because the spirit of wisdom has got them in a symmetric system, you're a third circler. Okay, now you can really think about melding that phenomenon into a monolithic mindal character, Maharaja mind.
So then many of us don't make it to third until like in Mansion Worlds.
Right.
Third mansion.
Yeah. Seventh.
Right. Well, maybe not that bad. But don't we dabble at
times? We touch the third circle at times?
No, it's not a touching.
It's not.
You're just moving towards that. You're moving towards it. You can conceptualize it.
You can smell it.
You have foresight. You can project your thoughts forward to that.
But you never are working in more than one time?
No. It's a lot like, the funny I often throw out, I experienced enduring peace one time.
No, you didn't.
I experienced being a third circler one time. No, you didn't.
No, you didn't. Yeah. Now, if you're worried about third circler, you ain't there.
No, I was just curious.
And the other thing, along Steve's thought there that I always bring out is the way you really temper that. So maybe I'm, at least a third circler. Is going back and reading about the normal planetary mortal epics, and what it says about a planet getting into light and life. And they make this astounding statement. They say, now, finally, more individuals are reaching the third circle during their mortal life.
So it's very far from us.
Okay. And I go, okay, so first of all, they're living about 500 years, and now finally they're making for third circular in their mortal life. And they're two notches beyond the wildest paradisiacal thing I can imagine. Our highest concept of heaven, on Earth, is basically the post-bestowal sun age in reality. We can't even imagine, Trinity teacher son in light and life. So that should be a humbling little statement to you.
Yeah, that's like way off.
It's like way take off. A deep breath. very likely that we're a long ways. Most of us are a long ways from it. But again, it's a normal distribution. See, remember, that horizontal one. There are always going to be individuals, that are 3 sigma, 4 sigma, off the center of the normal distribution. There are several standard deviations, very, very exceptional individuals, that fuse during their mortal lifetime. Mm-hmm. And then there's those that, don't even get to 6th circular in this life. So, there's this whole spectrum. Especially but most of us, when they're talking about, when they say, more of them are reaching third circular during their mortal life, what they're saying is that the center of that distribution now is moved way up there. Yeah. Instead of back here where we are, most likely there's a high probability you and I are this blob here, not in the, most of us are not in a tail, the low end tail, we're not in the high end tail either.
As long as we're on our way there.
On your way. Right.
That's a good place to be.
Make it to the mansion world. I mean, that's to be a really big thing.
Yeah. And even, take the extreme, even if you're not actually human-minded, but it's just a technicality. You get resurrected in the probationary nursery. You make the whole ascension career. You spend eternity, having to be in the immediate presence of the Father.
Consolation for him?
Anybody? Is that so bad?
Right, is that so bad?
Yeah.
I think one big retarding factor in people attaining higher circles in a life such as this, on a planet such as this, is that there's this herd mentality. People aren't really so much concerned with personal growth. They're concerned with fitting in and having a group. And,
looking good.
And,
those are people that look like this, not like this.
Yeah.
You're a flat hemisphere.
Yes.
Not a sphere.
Truncated.
Do you know many, I know it because I live in Boulder and because I read the Ranchi book and because I know all of you. I seem to know a lot of people who are concerned with their personal growth. But when you go out into the larger world, you meet many of them.
They're always like this with a screen at all times, and they're taking it out of their pocket like every 5 seconds.
There's an app for girls.
But at the same time, it's
been driving me crazy. I came out from an airplane, and they were all doing that, and I was trying to connect too with my cell phone. I couldn't do it because they're all going down the escalator like this, and I was like in a science fiction movie. It was so awful. So I didn't take it out
movies.
Until I got outside.
Well, isn't that a good thing?
Right when they get off the plane.
Yes. Isn't that a good thing, though, that isn't that a trait?
That they're fixated
just,
on a screen?
Just more of a grounded personality?
Well, I mean, again, you know, if what's going on is that they're just going about this really, really slowly, you know. But you have, you know, there is a reason why they say it's sad to record. You know, it's not that's the best that they can do.
Mm-hmm. That's
you know, it's sad to record that so many could do so much more with this life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of them don't even know that it's a possibility. No one's ever even told them the good news, you know, of what you could choose to do in this life.
Until they check out,
you know,
there's always time.
This life could be so much more. And how sad is it that it's so little for so many, and it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
You know, many, they're like we're just, you know, there are a lot of people on this planet that have no choice. This life is going to be pretty limited for them. But, you know, the good news is that's what the management worlds are for. But it's sad to record that so many that could be really pushing forward aren't choosing to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if we could get more people choosing to, more people were being talked about in this first Seraphim paper, there would be fewer people that the individuals in this next Seraphim paper would have to deal with, led by the Most High.
Preview of coming
to rule in the kingdoms of men. You don't want to be in the group of people that the Most Highs have to deal with, because you have not taken care of your inner life.
Right.
And so they have to deal with you externally, crudely. You don't want to be in that category. So take note of what they say in this first Seraphim paper, so you don't come under the over-control in the second Seraphim paper. All right, let's take a moment here.